Hello, welcome to all of you. I'm Atul Kohli, and along with Debra Yasher, I direct this program on democracy and development, which has sponsored this seminar. Our program, the Democracy and Development Program, is sponsored in turn by Princeton Institute for International and Regional Studies, which is directed by Kathy Newman. And so the first thank I want to give is to Pierce for providing the funds that then allow us to do these activities. The Democracy and Development Project has been in operation now for 3 years. We have been fortunate to have this funding. We have been able to invite very good people to join us. We have had two fellows every year. The first year we had Eva Bellin and Peter Evans. Then we had, no, and Barbara Stallings. Second year we had Patrick Heller and Peter Evans. This year we're delighted to have had Gay Seidman and Devesh Kapoor visiting us. And we hold a speaker series all years and conferences of this nature. So that's who we are. And I want to thank Pat Zimmer, who helped organize this conference in the logistical sense. The intellectual work was done by Gay Seidman and Devesh Kapoor, to whom I'm enormously thankful. I'm also delighted to have them here for the whole year. I'm feeling sad that they're on their way, that this comes to an end. But you get to my stage and you say, you get to my stage and you say, be thankful for what you had. So in that sense, I was delighted to have had them here. Who else should I thank? Pierce, Debra Yasher, Pat Zimmer, and these two folks who helped organize. That's it. Welcome to all of you, and I look forward to the good discussions.
Okay, I actually want to do some thanks too, and then do some housekeeping details. I want to thank Atul. Atul, this program has been wonderful. It's been a really wonderful year. And Vinay, wherever he is, has helped. Vinay, thank you, has helped with a lot of the logistical stuff. And Pat Zimmer, who's been amazing. The only thing she hasn't done is correct the typos in the various messages that I sent out to you. Sorry about that. Speaking of things that we sent out, we photocopied the wrong program. We photocopied the program rather than the schedule. So there should be a. Sorry?
Program from the last year conference.
It wasn't quite that bad, but the schedule it should be coming around. So if you have any questions about that, let me know. So I want to also thank Devesh, because in many ways this conference is really his brainchild. And I have been, in the course of organizing the conference and being in touch with you and getting your abstracts and thinking about this, this has forced me to think in a way about, I think about class a lot, but I really don't think about middle class stuff. And so for me, this has been a really interesting and provocative set of abstracts just coming and forced me to think about South Africa in a way that I haven't before. And I'm really looking forward to the discussion, and I'm really grateful to Devesh for doing that. Two other housekeeping things. We do have copies of the papers, but really I think only for the people who are presenting themselves, because many people ask that their papers not be circulated. They really are draft papers. So unless, if you don't have them and want them, maybe you could ask the authors if it's okay with them and for a specific paper, and we could get it copied for you. But we can't circulate them because so many of the authors, including me, ask that they be only for participants. So I mentioned the program. I think that's it. I think we are good to go. So thank you very much, and I look forward to getting to know all of you better.
All right, this is our first panel, and I think the two presenters have agreed that Yoshi's going to go first. Yoshika Herrera, please.
Okay. All right, I think we should.
15 to 20 minutes each.
Okay. okay, I am going to. My paper has a new title, slightly. Just called Class as a Social Identity, Comparing Measurement of Class, Gender, and Ethnicity. And I want to just give some introductory remarks. I don't spend that much time thinking about class. I spend a lot of time thinking about ethnicity. However, recently, in work on ethnicity, I started thinking about comparing ethnicity with other kinds of social identities. Why? Because just if you take a context like South Africa to say, well, I'm interested in ethnicity, how could you not say I'm also interested in class? Or in a lot of countries like India, how could you not be interested in caste or religion? Or in Russia, some ethnicities are considered religious identities, some are not. So the idea of how class or ethnicity relates to other social identities is something I've been thinking about recently. And gender as well. Empirically, I was motivated by the public health crisis in Russia, which, if you're not familiar, there's just been a very rapid rise in male mortality in particular, not female, but male mortality, which went up in the early 90s, then down in the late 90s, and then back up. So it's really not tracked with various economic developments in Russia. There's a big gender gap. So, and lots of people from different social sciences are working on this problem, and no one has really figured it out. But people think it has to do something with ethnicity, something to do with class. But what? Because, for example, the countries with the five highest suicide rates in the world, and suicide is partly related to the male mortality issue, are Russia, Ukraine, and the Baltic states. Some of the lowest suicide rates in the world are in the Caucasus and Central Asia. The Caucasus and Central Asia are much poorer, but they're just not doing nearly as poorly on a lot of different public health outcomes as some of the northern Slavic countries. So people think there's something there about these differences between the Caucasus, Central Asia, and the Slavic countries, but what is it? It's not really captured by census data. It's not captured just by income or education. So that's what has motivated my work, in addition to my work on measuring identity, to looking at this particular problem and how these different kinds of identities overlap. So I want to just, this is kind of a thought piece, and I want to just put out four points I think that we can have for discussion. So the first thing I want to talk about is theory versus data. That is the gap between theories of these kinds of identities and the actual data sets that exist. A second thing is the issue of comparison, which I talked a little bit about, but I'll go into a little bit more detail. And third, I get to an approach towards a little bit of an answer, I guess, which is my general argument, which is that I think we need to look at the content of social identities, which may seem obvious, but I think when you look into the data sets, you see it's not that obvious, particularly with class. And then finally, I just want to preview some previous work with co-authors on identity as a variable, which is a framework for getting at content, which I think may be useful for class, although we have mostly applied it to ethnicity so far. Okay, so the theory versus data sets. In the last 10 years, especially in comparative politics, there's been both recognition as well as actual work on the issue of the gap between theories of ethnicity and data sets that we have on ethnicity. So the early recognition of this problem came from the fact that people said, since Benedict Anderson and others came out with these constructivist views of the nation and of ethnicity, that view, the constructivist view of ethnicity, has come to just dominate, almost in a hegemonic way, the academic scholarship on ethnicity. It's just absolutely commonplace today to say the nation is socially constructed, etc. But some years ago, people realized, despite this work on constructivist theory, most of the data sets that we use on ethnicity are rather primordialist. So they either are census data, which typically ask at a certain point in time, what is your ethnicity or what is your nationality? Or one of the most commonly used data sets is the Ethno-Linguistic Fragmentation Index, which combines actually ethnicity and language. It was developed by Soviet ethnographers just sitting, in offices in Moscow, tracking what are the groups out there in the world that exist. And it counts the number of groups in a country. It also doesn't deal at all with any of the kind of constructivist theories of ethnicity. So now there's this move in comparative politics by Dan Posner, Kanchan Chandra, David Layton, myself, Evan Lieberman here at Princeton, Prena Singh, lots of people, to say, okay, now we need constructivist data sets of ethnicity that look at other kinds of things. So that's what's happening on the ethnicity front. on gender, I'd say, I'm not an expert on gender, but let me say, from what I have begun to read, you know, analyses of gender, I think, are dominated by feminist theory, which you may call constructivist, you may call structural, you can call it whatever you want, but it is not represented by sex differences. So most people would make a distinction between sex differences, male, female, and gender. And yet, when you look at, if you did a word search of articles in major journals on gender, any kind of quantitative work typically is looking at sex differences. So it could be sex differences in outcomes of some sort, inputs, etc. Not that that's not important, but that is kind of a gap between theories of gender and the data that we have on gender. Now, that could get to sort of larger theoretical issues of how you would measure certain kinds of theories, like how do you operationalize Joan Scott or something like that. Nevertheless, there is not the same move, as far as I know, in thinking about creating data sets on gender that more closely track the theory. So I think there's still a gap there. Now, on class, there's a lot of different theories out there. And I think one distinction between class and ethnicity, for example, is that I wouldn't say, from my reading of the work, that there's one kind of definition of class that dominates. People have different approaches. And so it's not the same as ethnicity in the sense that there's a lot of consensus on the ethnicity side on a constructivist view of ethnicity. Whereas on class, I think there's still a lot more theories out there. However, I would say most data sets are what I would call nominal, in the sense that they look at income or occupational categories, even in a very sophisticated way, like Eric Olin Wright, like these kind of more complex class positions. Still, what you're doing is looking at mostly individuals and their position in the economy. That's not that different from a kind of more sophisticated, say, look at nominal data sets on ethnicity. So, for example, in Russia, the census used to ask, what is your nationality? Just like that. And you said what your nationality is. Okay. In 2002, the census is really taken over by these constructivist anthropologists. So they changed the question to say, according to your own self-examination, what is your sense of national belongingness? And it's as convoluted in Russian as it sounds in English. And people would just say, what? What is this question? And then the enumerators would say, come on, it's just, what's your nationality? So, you know, but they're trying to say, you don't have a nationality. You have, what is your sense of national belongingness according to your own self-examination? Nevertheless, what they come up with is around 900 or so majorly recognized ethnic groups. Okay, so it's an expansion of the previous 100 and something to more. But still, it's a kind of nominal exercise in terms of asking what is it. So it doesn't get to the question of what does it mean to have one identity versus another, which is where I'm going with my talk. Okay, so there's the theory versus data sets issue, and I think that's an interesting point of comparison between class and ethnicity or gender. The other, but there's a little bit more than just the theory versus data sets. There's also certain issues that come up in studying all social identities, I think, that that have to be dealt with, whatever identity you're studying. So the first is the issue of multiple identities. And here, there's two kinds of, let's say, multiplicity. So one is you can have, if you think of identities in terms of types, so let's just use the term type. Other people use other terms for this. But let's say religious, ethnic, gender, etc., these types. So you can have multiple types. So you can be biracial, for example. So multiple ethnic identities. So I, myself, from that nominalist point of view, would be half Japanese, half something, English, Scottish, something. Now, one issue in terms of the theory data set issue is how would you deal with multiple identities within one type? So, for example, on the U.S. Census now, you have this multiracial question. Okay. But there's also the question of more than one type. So you have you have people of a certain ethnic group who may or may not be of the same religion, and what do you do with that? So, for example, in the last Russian census, there's about 10 different kinds of Tatars, okay? And some are Christian and most are Muslim. Now, some people would say a Christian Tatar is not a Tatar. Tatars, by definition, are Muslim. That's one little wrinkle. What does it mean to be one religious group versus one type? If you apply it to the Middle East, Christian Iraqis or Christian Lebanese, Christian Sunni, etc. Not Sunni, Christian. Lebanese versus Sunni or Shia Lebanese. So you can have religion plus ethnicity. You can have gender. You can multiply all these things. And again, it gets to the issue of how would you make sense of all these different identities, and how do existing data sets deal with this issue of overlap, either across type or within type? In addition, there is the problem of how do you draw a line between one versus another, and are identities even comparable? So some of my colleagues, for example, who work on gender, just say, you know, I don't care about identity. I do not think of gender in terms of social identities. I think of gender as this structural issue of, you know, perceived differences based on sex differences or something like that, and I just don't care about social identities. Okay, so that's one way to deal with it, just to say, this is not a social identity. To some extent, you can make that argument about class. You could say, I do not care about intersubjective shared understandings of this or that. I don't care what people think. I just want to know what their position is in the economy. Similarly, you could say, I don't care if there's a sense of solidarity amongst African Americans. I only care if somebody who's born African American in America has the same life chances as somebody else, and I would just like to know occupational category by race to know what's happening. Okay, but you could already see that there are certain things that may be overlap and certain ways in which there may be comparisons that you can make across these identities. So, for example, with gender, race, and religion and class, you could do the same kind of exercise of counting, for example, how many people are in different occupational categories. You could do that. But there are other ways in which there may be comparisons. So, for example, you could compare religious and ethnic groups in terms of language norms or in terms of norms about dietary restrictions or other kinds of things. So the first thing I want to argue is that there may be ways of disaggregating the content of identities that would make for useful comparisons, even if you wanted to say, you know, overall there are these large differences. But I think once you recognize the multiplicity of identities, either across types or within types, it brings up the theoretical question of how you differentiate them. And I think for that, then you have to start thinking about what does it mean to have one or another in order to make comparisons. Now, as a practical matter, this issue is dealt with in data sets in a couple of ways, which I find somewhat unsatisfactory. So one way to deal with this issue is to say, I'm only going to measure one thing. So, for example, Alberto Alesina said, hey, you know, the ethno-linguistic fragmentation index puts things together, puts ethnicity and language together. That's no good. Instead, I'm going to have my graduate students look at the Encyclopedia Britannica and code groups according to religion versus language versus ethnicity, and we'll have a separate data set on each thing. But then when you think about it for a minute, how sensible is that in a country like India or in Russia? So, for example, in Russia, Jewish is considered an ethnicity and is on the census, but Russian Orthodox is not. So that's a pretty important divide in the country on religion, and you have data in one that's mixed in with ethnicity and the other that's not. So as a practical matter, treating them separately doesn't really make sense. Similarly, if you were looking at, let's say, quote, ethnic parties in India, to say you only are going to look at ethnicity and not caste and not religion, does that really make sense? Would you be capturing, you know, what's important or what we think is important by the concept of ethnicity? So treating them separately in practice doesn't really work. What's happened recently is ethnicity has, as an alternative, has become broadened. So, for example, Kanchan Chandra, in her work, her new data set on ethnic parties in India includes religion, caste, ethnicity, all as part of that data set. Similarly, Evan Lieberman and Prerna Singh, they include different kinds of identity under the term ethnicity. And this is true in the literature too. Somebody like John L. Horowitz, who's a key figure in the ethnicity literature, says ethnicity covers differences of color, language, religion, tribes, races, nationality, and caste. Okay, so the other answer in the literature is to say, let's just combine everything together under the term ethnicity. But notice gender class are often not there. So I want to say it's reasonable to put things together because otherwise you would miss out on important phenomenon. But on the other hand, it's not very satisfactory because some social identities are left out. And by mixing things together, I don't think you really are able to capture the larger theoretical issue of what actually differentiates these identities. So here's my the beginning of an answer, I guess. So the first thing is I want to make an argument for content and why content matters and why we need to move beyond these lists of types of groups. So I already mentioned nominal types of data sets where you just name all of the possible groups that could possibly exist. So some people in the literature have made a distinction between nominal and activated identities. So the nominal exercise would be to say, let me think of a country and name every possible identity group that could exist in that country. And the critique of that is, what if nobody identifies with that category? So shouldn't we have a list of the politically relevant groups? So that's what Kanchan Chandra and Dan Posner have done by looking at the groups that are actually used, labels that are actually used. Nevertheless, these are still labeled. They're still just categories of types of people. Another answer to this is Rogers Brubaker and some of his co-authors suggest that we need to study groupness. That is asking, either in a binary fashion, do you identify with this group? Yes or no? So check a box. Or how strongly do you identify? So you have gradations of groupness. So you identify very strongly, not very strongly. You see this in a lot of US surveys. But those still ignore what I think is sort of fundamental issue of identity and the aspect of identity that is, I think, theoretically most interesting, which is what does it mean to be part of a group? So if you just take, for example, a foreign-born, middle-class, black, female, Christian New Yorker, in order to know how that identity will have any effect on behavioral outcomes that we care about, on voting, on where she may choose to live, what kinds of holidays she celebrates, what food she eats, anything about behavior that we might care about, we need to know about the content of that identity. And I would argue we need to know about the intersubjective or shared meaning of a collective identity. So what does it mean for people to say, if somebody says, I'm black in America, what does that mean? And for this, you actually have to move beyond the individual, because to get at this shared content, you have to look at what people within a group think about a certain identity. Okay, so that brings me finally to, in some ways, back to my previous work with my co-authors, Rawi Abdullah, Rose McDermott, and Ian Johnson on, we had a book that just came out. I have to just say that because it's relevant to the topic in the sense that the book is called Measuring Identity. And we, in that book and some other articles, have our own framework that we suggest. And I don't suggest it as this is the answer, but just as an example of one way of getting at content. So what we suggest is to get at this intersubjective shared content, you have to break types of content down into things that are comparable. So for example, constitutive norms, which are the norms, the formal or informal rules that say who's in the group and who's not in the group. That's one thing that you can compare across groups. So you can look at what norms that are the behavioral prescriptions shared by an identity group, how do those vary across groups or how are they similar? So are there ethnic group, what are the norms of a certain ethnic group? What are the norms of a certain religious group? That's one way of getting at a comparison, say, of religion and ethnicity. Similarly, of some of these other groups. Social purposes is a second type of content that we identify, which is just shared goals that a group has. So for a nationalist group, establishment of a nation state, for example, is typically a shared goal. That if you do not share in that goal, it's hard to consider yourself part of the identity group. For some religious groups, for example, evangelical Christians, proselytizing is a shared goal. If you don't have that goal, it's hard to say you're part of that group. So goals are sort of future-oriented, whereas norms are the obligations that convey who's in the group and who's not in the group. Another type of content is this relational comparison. And here's where I think class and gender are sort of comparable, in that to have an identity, sometimes it's defined in terms of a comparison with another group that you're not. And when you have hierarchical comparisons, so upper class, middle class, lower class, male versus female, this kind of relational comparison is critical to the definition of the group. Now, with ethnicity, some groups have this. So Japanese may say, we're not Chinese. But they don't say, well, we're not Algerian. You know, there's some kinds of comparisons that people make. And so sometimes it can be, you know, the whole. So in class, for example, you may have a comparison with all the other categories. With ethnicity, you may have some comparisons, but not the full range. Similarly with religion, some religious groups will compare themselves with other ones, but, you know, other groups they've never heard of. So it's just not part of their consciousness. So relational comparisons is another type of content. And finally, cognitive models or worldviews, there's different terms for this kind of aspect of identity content, but it has to do with how having an identity affects your interpretation of information that you get. How is it that when you lose your job, what does that mean to you if you're African American versus if you lose your job and you're white in America? You know, you may have a different interpretation of why you lost your job. Or if you see something happening in the world, you see this all the time with groups in conflict, that there's some event happens and one group interprets it one way and another group interprets it another way. So that's a way in which identity affects not just norms or preferences, but the formation of preferences in some ways by affecting the interpretation of meaning. So those are four types of content that we suggest you can analyze any social identity in terms of and be able to make comparisons, maybe not between the group at the macro level, but in terms of types of content across groups, which I think gets us a little bit more towards comparison. And finally, we argue that all of this kind of identity content is subject to contestation within the group. Every type of content is arrived at after a certain process of discussion, debate, deliberation. And you can have different levels of contestation over different types of content. You can have some kinds of content that's so agreed upon, it's almost become habitual or natural, and nobody contests it. You can have something else that is very contested. And more importantly, or as importantly, contestation is separate from the importance of a certain type of content to a group. So, for example, just taking Islam for an example, you may have something like homosexuality, which is, let's say, medium to high importance. And there may be some level of contestation over that. You maybe have something like what kind of toothbrush the prophet used. Okay, this is of low importance, but maybe high contestation. But it could be irrelevant. So contestation doesn't equal salience. Contestation equals the level of agreement within a group over a type of content. But how important some kind of content is to a group is separate to that. And I think that's an important point to keep in mind, that you can't just measure contestation to see what's important. And it's not the case that only important content is contested. It could be just the opposite. Something that's really important, it's really contested because it's so important. Or it could be something that's really important is not contested because it's so fundamental, you don't talk about it. So we think contestation goes along with this content. And you can, by looking empirically at contestation, I think that gives you, we think, a little bit of a solution to the issue of how you can say identities are both fluid and constructed and stable, because contestation gives you a sense of both the fluidity as well as stability to the extent you see a lot of contestation. So let me just conclude by saying I think it's reasonable to make an argument for looking at the meaning of class, for looking at the content of what does it mean to be in one class or another, even though I recognize that looking at this subjective shared understanding is not everybody's view of class, not the way lots of people would approach class. But I think to the extent we want to say class matters for some other kind of outcome, I think knowing a little bit about the content is probably going to be very important. By disaggregating that content, I think it gives us a more practical way of getting at class and other kinds of identities. And I didn't have time to go into this today, but I also think that content is really the way that we get to a real link between having an identity and an action. So norms would just be the most obvious case of that, but relational comparisons as well, if you look at social identity theory or other kinds of theories like that, really link certain kinds of content with action. So I think that's a way of connecting identity to actual outcomes. Thanks.